This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Consumer Issues here on Share Radio. It's time for This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. Joining me is editor Simon Lambert and journalist Ellie Laurie. And we were left floored this week by politics. I'm not talking UKIP members or Lancashire Council, but the pound.
Nervousness surrounding sterling after the Brexit vote. Something large hits the market, other algorithmic trading systems out there detect it, and everything piles on top of one another, and then the orders to sell are triggered, and it all becomes a cascading effect.
Sterling dropping to a 31-year low, Theresa May firing the starting gun for what looks like a hard Brexit. With all that going on, were we equally taken with the new Prime Minister's call for change as she closed the Conservative Party conference, the party of the working people?
Come with me as we rise to meet this moment. Come with me, and together, let's seize the day.
Carpe diem indeed. But actually, should we be thinking more longer term? I'm talking for our own lives here. Have you written a will?
The number of claims that end up in the High Court are really just the tip of the iceberg. Probably about 90% of claims will be settled before even reaching court.
Well, two-thirds of us haven't made provisions for our loved ones when we die. Inheritance disputes on the up, families torn apart. We answer one reader's questions. Say you do get a windfall for whatever reason, what would you do with it? We look at some options. Now, I got to hold and spend my first plastic fiver this week. Very excited. But should I have held on to it? One has sold for over $4,000. Is it because everyone thinks we're heading for a cashless society?
People can now choose credit cards, debit cards, contactless cards, mobile payments. The proportion of transactions in cash is gradually slowing.
And I'm sorry, but yes, it's that time of the year.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yeah, exactly. Hamleys has announced its top 10 Christmas must-have toys. A pedometer for kids, a game where you risk eating jelly beans flavoured like rotten fish and gone-off milk, and one that throws pie in your face. We go. So, editor Simon Lambert and journalist Ellie Laurie, what toys did you play with as a child? And do you think it says anything about you as a person now, I wonder? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Ellie.
Good morning. I always used to love playing with Lego as a kid, and I would sit there and play with it for hours and hours and hours. I adored Lego. And then the other thing I remember playing with is Star Wars toys. But the one thing I remember being really jealous of was one Christmas, my cousins were staying, and they both got Optimus Prime Transformers, and he basically transformed and he had a whole lorry back and everything, and it was just super cool, and I was
Robot
a bit jealous of that.
Sin disguise.
So yeah, cars, Lego, Star Wars, basically.
So you could have been a Jedi builder.
Yeah.
Not really what you're doing now, but that's okay. Ellie, for you?
I had a Tamagotchi. Loved my Tamagotchi. And then I went on brownie camp and it died. So it's not very good legacy from that. I can't even keep a plant alive even now. And I had a Furby. Love my Furby. Had a Furbish dictionary, try and understand it, but
my blank expression doesn't work so well on radio, but a Furby and a Tamagotchi. No idea. For me, it was wrestling dolls, micro machines and cricket balls. I mean, that might say something about me, but actually I saw a great tweet earlier. Save a fortune on Christmas presents by falling out with family and friends. Lay the groundwork now so it doesn't look like it's about presents. Great tweet.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Weekdays from 9 till 12. Wants your feedback. Contact the program by tweeting at Share Radio UK. Text 66777 and start the text with the word share. Or email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. If it's about money and it matters to you, it matters to us.
A very warm welcome. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the finance website of the year. This is Money. You're back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and journalist Ellie Laurie to go through some of the stories that they've been looking at this week. And they say, well, a week is a long time in politics, and it really is. Putting aside implosions at UKIP and the government intervention in fracking, the Prime Minister fired the starting gun on Brexiting Britain and set out her vision for the future. One base, she says, shares on fairness and on change. She closed the Conservative Party conference with a mammoth hour-long speech. Our reporter Anna Jones was there.
Theresa May told a hall packed full of the Tory faithful in Birmingham that June's referendum result wasn't just about people's frustration with the EU.
It was about a sense, deep, profound and, let's face it, often justified, that many people have today, that the world works well for a privileged few, but not for them.
She insisted the Conservatives can fix things.
Come with me and we'll write that brighter future. Come with me and we'll make that change. Come with me as we rise to meet this moment. Come with me, and together, let's seize the day.
Along the way, the PM had a go at the rich and powerful, saying they must be fair when it comes to paying taxes and looking after workers.
A director who takes out massive dividends while knowing that the company pension is about to go bust. I'm putting you on warning. This can't go on anymore. A change has got to come, and this party is going to make it.
And she took a dig at divisions within Labour.
Fighting among themselves, abusing their own MPs, threatening to end their careers, tolerating anti-Semitism and supporting voices of hate. You know what some people call them? The nasty party.
Labour says the Tories still have no plan for leaving the EU, and this isn't a shift to the centre as promised, but to the right. Unions insist we're still miles away from a country that works for everyone.
Oh, we also heard from Chancellor Philip Hammond ahead of next month's autumn statement. So is the economy in good hands, especially as we saw the pound drop to a 31-year low this week? Before we get on to that, I want to know if it's all right. Simon, firstly to you, your initial thoughts on the Prime Minister's vision for Britain, her speech there, some rather choice remarks. I heard someone say it was a little bit like Ed Miliband meets the Daily Mail speech. A move away from the Cameron Osborne era. What did you make of it, Simon?
I thought Theresa May's speech was quite good, actually. I think that she has sort of aligned herself with, everybody tries to align themselves with hardworking people. If hardworking people had a pound for every time some politician had tried to align themselves with them, they would be rich and they wouldn't have to work so hard. But I do think that she's positioning herself in the right place. I think that since the financial crisis, despite the talk about never again, we're not going to allow this to happen, reform the banking sector and all these things, we have bent over backwards when it comes to banks, the financial sector, and large global businesses. And I don't think that it's necessarily done our recovery from the financial crisis any good. I don't think it's done people's confidence in the financial sector and in large corporations any good. And I don't think it's done the financial sector or the large corporations any good either, to be pandered to constantly. So I actually think that in the long run, it's probably a good move. And if you're going to set down a marker that says, no more of this, we're going to change direction slightly, even if you're really not going to change direction that much, then now's not a bad time to do so.
Ellie, I want to know your view, a Hammond-May combo, I'm not talking about cars here, obviously, versus the Cameron-Osborne. What do you think? Economy in good hands now?
I think she, like Simon said, I think she has been fairly convincing in aligning herself with working people more than Cameron ever did. As to whether the economy is in good hands, I feel like it's probably quite early days to say.
It depends what happens with Brexit, doesn't it? We'll get on to that in a short moment. But I did rather like this lady is for turning the country around, says a Daily Mail headline this week. Now, she called for change, promised there'd be a party for the workers, moved away from small government ideals, I guess, of the previous regime and traditional Tory party, referencing failures in the energy, housing, broadband markets, a need for intervention. Should business, though, be concerned? Has she shaken that Thatcher Mark II tag? Well, here's Share Radio's Ed Bowsher.
A lot of it was just emphasising and expanding on what we've heard before. The core theme was this idea that she wants to represent everyone and that she's perhaps suggesting that the previous government was too close to the powerful and the rich. But I think it was interesting, the real emphasis on how markets don't always work was striking. I didn't expect to hear that so firmly argued. So that's perhaps the most striking thing that we saw. Also interesting that she's made very clear she backs the HS2 railway project, which will inevitably be very expensive. I thought she might dump that. Also interesting, some of her sort of more communitarian thoughts, when one of us falters, our instinct is to reach out our hand and help. Again, we wouldn't have heard that from Thatcher.
So, Ellie, should businesses be concerned, you think? Ed did mention there the HS2 project. We got fracking intervention. People are thinking perhaps we're going to get Heathrow as well. So she's really pushing forward quickly with these infrastructure changes.
Oh, absolutely. But I think, as Simon said, this is a critical time if you're going to make big sweeping changes. Now would seem the right time, and she's, you know, on the front foot. I think it's a good thing.
Well, I think the big thing that businesses have been concerned about is this talk about listing foreign employees, which Amber Rudd decided, yeah. I think it was Amber Rudd, decided
it
to
was.
Announce.
Home Secretary Amber Rudd facing a backlash on that.
And I think, to be
one.
Honest, I think that sits very badly with a lot of people. It doesn't sound right. It sounds like, oh, we're going to list them so we can pick on them. I understand the sentiment behind it, saying if we want Britain to progress as a country, then we need to be training up our own workers and getting our workers up to the standard where, you know, we've got this great pool of them and pushing them forwards rather than just recruiting in people from overseas. Because actually that is the way that you do build up your knowledge and your skills base. But what about all those people from overseas who've moved here and worked for these companies and lived here for years and years and years? Those people are adding to our knowledge and our skills base. I know plenty of people who are from overseas and have moved here. And I think one of the great mistakes that we made after the Brexit vote, and I think this is a great mistake that's been made by both the British government and by the EU, is I think that both the British government and the EU should have come out and said, whatever happens, if you are already in a country and you are living there and you are working there and your life is there, you are not going to suddenly be disadvantaged by this. And I think that that applies just as well for an Italian or a Spaniard or a Frenchman or a Polish person or a Polish lady working in the UK as it does for a British expat living in France, Spain, or working in Munich or anything else like that. I think that, you know, there's a human element here, and I think that that's really important to remember as to how this comes across to people, because how this comes across can be twisted in a variety of different ways, and I think we have to be very, very careful that it doesn't get twisted in a way that we don't want it to get twisted. And so I think that that statement was a mistake. As for the other stuff that businesses have, well, I mean, you know, if we're going to kickstart the economy and get the economy going in a way that doesn't just involve cutting interest rates, printing money and pumping up the housing market, then I would say that would probably be quite good news for British business.
Well, all of this, I suppose, as Ellie, you rightly pointed out, in terms of it's too early to tell us now. I mean, we got to the start of the conference, Theresa May saying she intends to secure the right deal for Britain when triggering Article 50, frustrating investors and European leaders who are seeking greater detail on the contours of Brexit, should we say. The pound fell on the news that Article 50 would be triggered before March next year. And I suppose it all depends on what sort of deals you can get. But then at the end of the week, we saw it fall to a 31-year low, unsettling stock markets and early Asian trading, slumping as much as 6% before rebounding. Something called a flash crash, we understand. Is algorithms? Is it dodgy dealings? Is it Brexit? Well, John Hardy, head of FX strategy at Saxo Bank, spoke to Share Radio.
Clearly, some order hit the market in a time when liquidity is quite poor. Maybe not so many orders in the market because of the nervousness surrounding sterling after the Brexit vote. So when something large hits the market, other algorithmic trading systems out there detect it, and everything piles on top of one another, and then the orders to sell, to get out, stop-loss orders, are triggered. And again, because it's a bad time of day, it all becomes a cascading effect that drives these remarkable moves. Classical flash crash type scenario. There's a lot of searching around for this. There's some that are pointing to some Hollande speech in France. The UK needs to pay the price for voting to leave the European Union, but I don't. That's an excuse. It's clearly some order-driven event. And then again, this cascading order effect being set in motion. I think for now, you're going to need to see a pretty strong official response on this. No central bank or government can have this kind of volatility in any developed country in their currency. It's just unacceptable. So I think we'll see some kind of strong response. I don't know what that response will be. I certainly think it takes the whole rate cut scenario entirely off the table from the Bank of England. I think that was silly talk to begin with. If this kind of action keeps up, you're going to start to see the Bank of England hiking rates to defend their currency like an emerging market country. So I would suspect we see some stabilization in the near term if current levels are slightly higher. And then whether we go back close to those lows, I can't say, but I think we'll probably be more or less stable in a range, at least. Maybe volatile range, but in a range next month or so.
And that was John Hardy there from Saxo Bank. Before we talk about his thoughts on cutting interest rates and QE and central banks and the like, what the heck is going on? What is a flash crash, Simon? What happened?
Well, a flash crash It's a phrase that was really coined a few years ago when there was this sudden crash in the US markets that then, you know, suddenly bounced back. And what happened overnight was as the Asian markets opened, the pound basically suddenly fell off a cliff and dropped. It actually dropped 10%. Basically, it dropped from $1.26 to just below $1.14. But that trade, that there was an outlying trade there at that $1.14, and that was actually cancelled by Thomson Reuters, who run the index. But that still left a 6% drop, which then bounced right back up within minutes. So the flash crash is essentially a phrase for this. If you look at the chart, and this doesn't really work so well on the radio, but it sort of just plunges and then bounces back up. Now, this has happened in a week when the pound has already been, you know, hugely volatile. The first thing that happened on Monday morning, or even overnight Monday, when there were reports that Theresa May was going to make a speech, she was going to say that we were off. You know, we weren't going to, as some people seem to think, that Brexit might just mean that we put it on the top of the to-do pile and forgot about it, swept that pesky referendum vote under the rug. She actually said, no, we're actually going to do this. And the pound started falling. And I think this is because the markets are looking at it and going, well, do I really want to be holding these pound denominated assets? Do I want to be buying into pound denominated assets? Do I want to be holding pounds if I think that this uncertainty is going to cause the pound to fall further? So you get this situation where it starts tracking down. And then it's already fallen to a, you know, 31-year low. And then we had this flash crash overnight. As we speak now, the pound is basically back up. It started at about 126 before that, but it's now at 123, yeah. Which, you know, it's still down considerably to where it was yesterday evening. And whilst these flash crashes are very unusual events, the suggestion is that we're probably going to see a lot more of this. And the suspicion was that this was caused either by a rogue trader, not a rogue trader, a fat finger trade, someone basically pressing too many buttons, selling too much stuff. The French also got the blame.
François Hollande,
yes, came out and said that Britain had to suffer for Brexit, couldn't go soft on Britain. Mm-hmm. Or then the theory is that it was actually a trading algorithm reacting to news. You have these algorithms that basically follow news feeds, Twitter, headlines and things like that, overreacted in some way to Monsieur Hollande's crackdown. And that then triggered it to sell, which then triggered other algorithms. And there was a chain reaction that led to this sudden sort of dive down and then a bounce back up. It basically just shows how completely crazy a lot of the financial markets and a lot of trading is. You like to think that there's actually real people out there mm-hmm. making real decisions about this, but it isn't. It's just computers making millions of trades every second.
Well, exactly what I was about to say there. Ellie, the Bank of England is investigating the cause of that sharp fall in the value of the pound in overnight trading in Asia. But anyone listening, even if you're quite financially savvy, will be listening to what Simon's just said and gone, what on earth? Someone with a fat finger or a few little computer algorithms can mess something up like that. This is outrageous.
Yeah, it's terrifying stuff. And the problem is, as we were discussing on the way here, once you have a mistake or an algorithm goes a bit wonky, then other algorithms react from that, traders react, and then it's a whole chain reaction. It gets worse and worse, and everyone's quite jittery at the moment, obviously, with Brexit. So these kind of things just aren't very helpful, to be honest.
Okay, well, that's what's happened to the pound. But FTSE, what's happening there? Here's Ross Mould, Investment Director at AJ Bell. Looks rather solid.
It's simple mathematics. I mean, roughly two-thirds of the FTSE 100's revenues come from overseas. So as you said, if the pound goes down, then those revenues are worth 10% more on a strictly translational basis. So that's particularly helpful for the companies like oils, who report in dollars, the pharmaceutical companies, the mining companies, who have big dollar revenues or have big overseas assets, and also to a degree the tobacco companies, the drinks companies. So you're looking at, you know, some really, really big constituents of the FTSE 100 there, whether it's Shell, BP, AstraZeneca or Diageo. The company, but as you say, it's not win-win. There are some companies who are finding life harder, and they're generally the domestic players, the retailers, because they have a lot of imported raw materials.
OK, well, tell us, Ellie, what's going on with the FTSE then?
So basically, in the last few days, the FTSE 100 almost broached its record highs. You know, what's going on there seems strange. You know, there's a lot of turmoil going on economically. But really, as Russ said, it's about these big overseas earners. They dominate the FTSE 100. The bulk of their earnings are not in the pound, essentially, which means when they're translated back into profits, they are worth more. As he said, less good for the domestic stocks, you know, your high street companies or companies that are a bit smaller in the FTSE 250 that maybe take most of their earnings from the UK. It's going to hit them hard, you know, because the pound is hitting these huge lows.
Mm.
So not all good news, essentially.
Should we care about the pound going up and down? Just the average person on the street. How's it going to impact me from day to day?
They do, you know, you'll care when you go to get your euros.
Would
or
love
your
to
dollars.
Be able to go away to America. Okay. But if I'm not.
The other thing would be inflation. We've not seen much of an uptick in inflation, but we could if the pound continues to go lower, which, well, it's hard to predict, but probably will. You know, that's going to squeeze consumer spending power. That's not going to be great going forward.
I also heard some advice about buying your fridges now. Big electrical items likely to become more expensive after Christmas because of the weaker pound. So retailers have protection in place against currency fluctuation, known as hedges. Many of them start to run out around Christmas time. So imports become more expensive, leading to higher prices. Possibility January sales may not be as generous as in previous years, Simon?
Maybe. I mean, obviously, I would advise you only to do that if you actually need a new fridge.
That's a good point.
Otherwise,
yep.
You will just be wasting money on an extra fridge that you don't want. But it's true. All these things are going to come in. I tell you, if you go fill your car up tomorrow morning, it's going to cost you more than it did a week ago, probably, due to the fact that oil is priced in dollars. But going back to the FTSE 100,
you've written in your investor blog. Tell
us. Yeah. Well, I had that Richard Buxton in the back of my cab the other day. No, I had Richard Buxton, a very experienced fund manager and the chief executive of Old Mutual Global Investors on the Investing Show the other day. He also manages the Old Mutual UK Alpha Fund. We were talking about, you know, what on earth is going on here. And I mean, he said, at the moment, to be honest, it's very, very simple. It's all about the currency. And he said, if you look at the FTSE in dollar terms, it's absolutely flat. But in sterling terms, we're just going up as the currency gets weaker. And actually, I commented that he was being a little bit kind to the FTSE there, as actually, despite it having risen 11% since the EU referendum vote, the pound at that point was down 14%. So in dollar terms, we're actually down. So whilst it might look like your investments are up, if you measure them against the rest of the world, then your investments are down. But me and Ellie were talking about this earlier, and there is this question of like, well, that matters if you do see that inflation come in and start eating into those investments. But if we don't see that inflation, then say, for example, your pension is invested in a default pension fund, it's probably going to be biased towards the UK stock market, right? So the upshot of this is that your pension pot is now worth more. People, if they went and checked their pension pots, would probably find that their pension has gone up in value by a decent amount over the last couple of months. Now, as long as you don't see the inflation that suddenly eats into that, and you don't plan on using that pension pot to retire anywhere overseas, then you are definitely going to see a benefit from it. And I mean, the other thing that Richard said was that at the moment, it has been this incredible trend. And I pulled out a chart and published it in my column. And it does show this very strange, almost mirror image of the FTSE and the pound versus the dollar. And he said, you know, if sterling suddenly goes to 115 against the dollar, which he said some people are suggesting it will, if you use the same maths as what is going on at the moment, that would be 7,700 on the FTSE. He said, you know, we're all sitting here laughing and that sounds crazy, but we would have said it sounded crazy on the morning of the 24th of June when we were sat here talking about the referendum result if basically you'd have said what's going to happen next, and I'd have said, well, I tell you what, in 3 months' time, stock market be up more than 10%. You would have gone, no, it won't.
So in sum then, you talked there about the vote. To bring it all together before we move on to happier subjects like wills, post-Brexit vote, rather confused economic times. We're getting a load of economic data that's showing things aren't, well, looking too bad. And actually on your website this week, quote, we got it wrong on Brexit. Bank of England admits it was too pessimistic amid signs the economy has entered a sweet spot. So did economists get it wrong about Brexit? First, here's finance expert Kevin Pratt from Money Supermarket.
There's an old joke that says if you laid every economist in the world end to end, they still wouldn't reach a conclusion. Any issue of this sort, you're going to have people think one thing and argue very cogently for it, and people on the other side will be just as persuasive. I think what happened with Brexit is that nobody knew for sure. We were going into, and we still are going into, completely uncharted territory. So maybe it was slightly rash of the Bank of England to be so definite about what it thought might happen. But on the other side, you have to think, well, they did take definite action to try and improve the situation as they saw it. So we saw the cut in interest rates and we saw an increase in quantitative easing. So they have, it's not just speculation on their part, they've actually backed their judgment with concrete action, which has affected the whole of the country. And we're still seeing these things unwind. We're still seeing people calling the housing market in different ways, saying house prices are starting to fall or stagnate. And other people say, no, the housing market is much more resilient and prices are still going up. We're seeing the pound decline in value on the international currency exchanges. And that's great for people who are importing, but it's bad news for people who are exporting. Or is it the other way around? Nobody ever knows. So we've got all these different factors, different opinions. I just wonder whether anybody really benefits from trying to be definitive about one of these topics.
So did they get it wrong, Simon? Is that it for QE and interest rate cuts and the like?
Maybe for now it's that for rate cuts. There's still an outside possibility we might see another rate cut before the end of the year. Although, as was pointed out earlier, if the pound keeps falling, then we're going to start having to battle to protect the pound, which I remember that not ending well the last time we did it, ERM. But Ben Broadbent said, you know, the Bank of England said, the central projection in the August inflation report didn't involve a recession, simply a slowing in the rate of growth. But that slowing looks so far to have been more moderate than we feared. That is true. But I think it's very early to tell at the moment what's going on. We've seen terrible data in July, then pretty good data for August. Things have been quite resilient. Property market's slowing down a bit, but all the sort of the construction survey was good, the services survey was good, the manufacturing survey was good. The pound is going to help our exporters. It's not going to help anybody going on holiday. Fortunately, it's autumn, and so most people won't be going on holiday for a good few months, so that won't depress them too much. So it's not too bad. But I think you need to look at this in a year's time or in 2 years' time and see what's happened then. But as I've said before, you have to bear in mind that 52% of people voted for us to leave the EU. 52% of people thought that was a good idea. Some of them probably thought it was a good idea, but the economy would suffer. But that still means there's a sizable chunk of people who are probably wandering around feeling fairly optimistic. And there is an optimistic case to be made for this. There is an optimistic case to be made for us expanding our free trade, for us, you know, being able to be more nimble, make quick decisions, to do things that we wouldn't be allowed to do under EU rules, such as, you know, even things like saving our steel industry and stuff like that. So there is an argument to be made for that kind of stuff. And if the positive line of that can keep being pushed, and if Philip Hammond comes out on the, I can't remember what day it is, in November, delivers his autumn statement, says he's going to invest some money in infrastructure, but isn't talking about projects like High Speed 2 and Heathrow that, let's face it, and God knows when you'd ever see a spade in the ground for either of those two. If he's talking about things like filling in potholes, building more schools, building more hospitals, built in order to encourage people to want more houses to be built, then we might genuinely see a proper uptick in the economy. And a very interesting thing actually happened, wasn't that much reported on, is that the government has basically set aside this £2 billion fund to buy properties, to basically underwrite house building. So what will happen is it wants house builders to build houses quicker. And so the house builders have said, we can't build houses quicker because we don't want to build them so fast that we can't sell them. So what they're going to do is they're going to underwrite this. And it's going to be like, for a lot of these houses, they're going to try and build on brownfield land or public land that's being freed up. And so they're going to encourage the house builders to build quicker, use new building technologies, you know, like people talk about flat pack homes and stuff, to get these homes up quickly. And if they can't sell them, the government will underwrite this. It'll take them on, it'll rent them out to people and things like that. So you could actually see an uptick, you know, in building and in construction, which would deliver a far more healthy boost to the economy than just the simple uptick in house prices that we've seen from things like Help to Buy.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Welcome back. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the finance website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and journalist Ellie Laurie to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. Now, we've just been speaking about rising house prices. Halifax, indeed, saying this week property values in September up 5.8% year on year. But one of the consequences you may not think of immediately is inheritance disputes. Now, they've reached record highs with the number heading to court 8 times higher than in 2005. More complicated families are also to blame. And it doesn't help that 2/3 of us haven't written a will. And yet, I'm sorry to say this, but 100% of us will die. Partner at law firm specialising in this area, Knockolds, Daniel Winter, spoke to us about this.
Actually making a claim in court is the last resort. And so the number of claims that end up in the High Court are really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of how many claims are going on in the background. Probably about 90% of claims will be settled before even reaching court. There's a combination of factors that are causing the increase. One that cannot be overlooked is the rising value of estates in general. People these days, if they own a property, their estate is going to be worth several hundred thousand pounds, if not more. The pot potential beneficiaries may claim from is that much bigger, which makes making a claim financially more viable. I think one of the biggest factors that puts people off is the potential cost they may have to invest in taking a case forward, and the risks of losing are often outweighed by what money is available. But when the pot is significantly large, it's an easier decision to make. Secondly, it is the more complex family structures, because these days it's not uncommon for there to be second marriages, even third marriages, and all the children from those marriages. If you don't make a will, then you're missing out on the greatest opportunity that you have to determine where you want your money to go.
Absolutely right. Daniel Winter there from Knockolds. And of course, we all sit here, each of us having written a will, because I remember a couple of months ago, Simon, having this discussion on the show with you, and you made that promise. Obviously, you've got a couple of kids as well to think about and a lovely wife. And so you have gone great guns, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. Mm. Yeah. So do you want to ask me the question?
Tell me about your plan, your plan to write a will. It is, by the way, everybody, free wills month in October. So you can do it for free at many places. But so, Simon?
Yes, I don't have a will.
Right.
And I've been told off for this before on a number of occasions. Yeah, it's just one of those things that I, like many other people, I just haven't got round to. It's a combination of inertia and you don't think of it, you don't have the time, you think, oh, how am I going to find the time to do that? But I am going to get a will. And in fact, what I'm going to do in getting my will is I'm going to get a will and I'm going to write about it. And I'm going to explain to people what I was told to put in my will, the things that I wouldn't have thought about to put in my will, and what all the things that are going in it mean. So I have found a friendly solicitor to help us out, and myself and my wife are going to go down there and we're going to do that, and then I will be able to explain to everyone why my will is written as it is. Because if I'm going to be entirely honest, I think wills are, the way that they are written is not very good. My dad's will, for example, when he died, reading it, it just makes almost no sense whatsoever. It's written in pure legalese.
Yeah.
And I think that is potentially one thing that does turn people off and put people off, is the fact that these things, whenever they've encountered one, it's just so incomprehensible. Mm. And so I think there's a lot to be done for making it so that people understand it. I know that the legal profession says there has to be certain legal terms in the way that it's written, but the sum total of that is I don't have a will. I'm going to get one, I promise.
I was going to say, yeah, you're probably right about the language, but no, I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it. I'm sorry, Simon. But so you've got a plan in place. That is a start, at least. Ellie, you a will?
Georgie, I don't have a will, but okay. I don't have any money. So
right, that's fair enough.
Fine.
That was my excuse as well. So that's all right. We don't have to dwell too long on that one. So you don't have a will, but you will get one when...
Well, I've got no children. I'm not married. Mm. It's getting a bit depressing, actually.
Pay rise, Simon, I think, is in order.
Hint. No, yeah. I don't know. I guess I've got a coffee machine that someone could get in the event of my passing. Yeah. No, I will get one. It's now at the forefront of my mind, because we all will die. Sobering thought, but it's 100% possibility. So I'll get one.
Well, good, good. And Simon, I'm already working on next week's show then, in preparation of that will that you're going to tell us about. So that's fantastic. The next week's show's in the bag already. But specifically on your website, why we're talking about wills, yes, inheritance disputes are on the up, quite phenomenally, actually. But you've got a query from a reader. Now, they say, my ex-husband remarried, but then died without making a new will, so is his old one with me still valid? Tell us a bit more about this, Ellie.
So essentially the answer to that is no, the will is no longer valid. If you divorce, your spouse is cut out of your will, essentially. Mm-hmm. If you have children, that the money will go to them. If you remarry, the money will go to that person. Is that right?
There's this thing where it's this weird thing, as Ellie said, where if you divorce, you're severed from the will, but the will remains intact. Whereas then if that person remarries, the will is then invalidated and they need a new will, which you can understand why people get confused by wills, can't you?
Yeah, minefield.
But I guess the question is, off the back of this, if your will says that you leave everything to your wife or your husband, which a lot of people do for inheritance tax reasons, because then the surviving person will pass it on, what happens if you then get divorced and they're severed from the will and then there's then no one in the will? Yeah. So I think that what happens then is it then passes down via this sort of, there's this kind of tree of descendancy that it goes down, you know, to your children and then so on and so on. And what you really want to avoid happening, and what solicitors always tell people and experts always tell people as to why they should get a will, is you don't want your money and your belongings and everything that you own in life to be following down that tree. What you want is for them to be going where you want them to go.
I don't want to say anything about your readers, but if you've severed yourself from the life of your former partner and you didn't get certain monies in the divorce, really, why would you expect to get some money from your ex-husband's will? Am I being unreasonable there?
Well, if you were together for a long time, I'm not sure it's unreasonable.
You broke up. You divorced.
Well, ideally, you should have had a divorce settlement.
Yeah, exactly.
However, there was a story that we had a short while ago that said that there's this emerging trend of couples ending up fighting over money who actually divorced a number of years ago, but basically got themselves a sort of cheap, quickie DIY divorce, and they never actually came up with a financial settlement. And because they didn't come up with a financial settlement, that means that one of the partners can then, in the future, go after one of the other partners. So, for example, say you were a couple and you got divorced, mm-hmm. and then the wife, or the ex-wife, won the lottery. Well, if you didn't have that financial settlement, the ex-husband could go after her for some of the lottery win, even though it was after they got divorced. And a far more likely thing to happen than win the lottery, as I should point out, I have played the lottery every right. week since it started, and the chances of me winning it are practically zilch, but I know those numbers. A far more likely thing than winning the lottery is that you might come into an inheritance of some form. You might strike it lucky with your business. You might suddenly earn more money. You might do something like that. And you could find that someone comes after you for money. And there was a famous case, wasn't there? There was the guy who's the green energy entrepreneur. I want to say Ecotricity, but I might
yes,
be wrong.
I think that's
so,
right.
Yeah. His ex came after him for some of his fortune, even though when they'd split up, he had no money and he'd made his fortune and started his business after they'd split up.
I think in that case, they had a son and who knows? The entrepreneur, you know, was allowed to go on and found this business while his wife or ex-wife was raising this child. So perhaps it's fair enough that she is compensated for that.
It was the green energy tycoon Dale Vince, indeed. Okay, so we'll put wills to one side, but say you do get a windfall, inheritance or otherwise, the question is, what would you do with it? Now, you've got another email this week from a reader, someone with a rather welcome problem, I imagine, of what to do with 50 grand. Well, let it never be said that economists don't like a hypothetical, so let's go on a spree, shall we? So throw sense out of the window, if you would, first and foremost. 50 grand in your hand right now, Ellie, what would you do with it?
Oh, buy a one-way round-the-world plane ticket, probably.
Ooh, that sounds a good idea.
No, I personally would probably invest it.
No, we'd sensible is coming later. Sensible is coming later. This is throw sense out the window.
For me, travel would be the ultimate, I think.
Simon?
The awkward thing would be that, obviously, I have, you know, responsibilities in my life and things like that. And it's not, that's not enough money to give up work on. So basically I couldn't just, you know, nip off. But I think what I would do is I would probably try and do something sensible with some of it, like invest some of it for the future. I could pay off some of my mortgage or something like that. But I would definitely spend some of it. I think that if you do get a windfall like that, and that if you are comfortable enough that you can afford to do something frivolous with it, do something frivolous with some of the money. Treat yourself, basically. You deserve to be treated. Treat yourself.
You do indeed. But I do want to ask, I mean, you two, very established financial journalists, you must get your friends come up all the time and saying, you know, what do I do with this? What do I do with that? So say someone comes up to you and I've got a £50,000 windfall, for example. I know you're not financial advisors, but what factors do you want to know about their financial situation before you'd start perhaps discussing with them what to do with it?
Their capacity for loss is probably one of the most important ones. Their time horizon and their goals. It just varies so much from person to person.
I mean, is debt an issue? Would you pay off debt? Would you have a house, yes, mortgage,
it
deposit?
Is. So if you've got debts that are on high interest rates, then the traditional advice is that you should always pay that off. Now, what this question was asking about was whether to pay off the mortgage or invest the money.
Tell us the reader's situation.
The reader said, I've recently inherited £50,000. Should I use it to overpay on my mortgage or to start investing? This is a great question, and it's one that chimed with our readers because, you know, this story went straight to the top of the stories that people were reading. And so we stuck it straight to the top of the homepage and people just kept reading it all day long. And the traditional advice would have been overpay your mortgage because, A, that's tax efficient. Because if you think of the fact that you have to pay your mortgage payments out of your taxed wages, by overpaying it, you know, it's a very tax efficient thing to do. Secondly, by overpaying it, the amount of years that it will knock and then continuing to pay it at the same rate, you'll clear that mortgage much earlier. You'll therefore pay a lot less interest. And the other reason is that that is a clearly identifiable gain that you can make with that money. If you've got a mortgage that lasts for 25 years on a 4 or 5% interest rate and you pay off 50 grand of it early, you can see exactly how much money you can save. You'll see your exact return from that. Whereas if you invest it in the stock market, well, it might go up by 6% if you're lucky, or it might only go up by 2%, or it might fall in value, certainly over the short term potentially. So there are those two things to bring into play. But what's changed the game a little bit here is the fact that interest rates are so low. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a mortgage on a 2% interest rate, you might even have a mortgage on a 2-year fix on a 1% interest rate. Is it still worth you using that money to pay that off? Or could you get a better return from investing that money? Because if you look at it over the long term, and if you work on the basis of long-term returns and past performance, no, you know, guide to future gains and all that kind of stuff, but the stock market's returned around kind of 4 to 5% above inflation over the long, long term. So if you look at it over a 25-year horizon, then you should theoretically hope to be getting those gains compared to saving the money of a 1% or 2% mortgage interest rate. So it's kind of muddied the waters a little bit. And so I think that what a lot of people said in comments was, why don't you do half and half? Or actually, what a lot of people said in comments, which I liked, was, why don't you spend some of the money, spend 10 grand, and then do half and half? So treat yourself with some of the money, and then do half and half. You know, put half onto your mortgage, half the other way. The other thing you could do is get an offset mortgage. Then you can put it in a savings account, balanced against that offset mortgage, and then if you want the money back, you can get it back.
Nodding along there, Ellie.
Absolutely. I don't have a mortgage, but I asked my boyfriend this morning what he would do with his mortgage, and he said that he would choose to overpay rather than invest the money. And I think that's because it's such a psychological thing. The concept of being mortgage-free, I think, in this country is everyone's dream, isn't it? But if you're going to be penalised for overpaying, you know, that is real money that you're losing. So it's good to think carefully about that as well. I think half and half seems like a sensible resolution.
I think so as well. OK, so I wasn't exactly £50,000 richer, nor did I get a windfall, but I did get rather excited this week when the cash machine gave me not one, but 4 shiny, silky new plastic notes. Winston Churchill's face imperiously looking up at me on the new £5 note. That's what it's worth, isn't it? Well, maybe not. One with a low serial number just sold for a whopping £4,150 at a Bank of England charity auction. After just weeks, the notes have become highly sought after by collectors. But why? Perhaps with the latest poll showing over 40% of us will be happy to dump Churchill and the rest and pay only by card if they could, does that give us an indication as we head towards a cashless society? Here's Victoria Cleland, Chief Cashier at the Bank.
The Bank of England's been issuing banknotes for about 322 years, and I think we'll be continuing to issue them for a long time to come. People can now choose credit cards, debit cards, contactless cards, mobile payments and things. And what we're seeing is that the proportion of transactions in cash is gradually slowing. So last year it came below 50% for the first time, but it's still very nearly half of all transactions. But we're still seeing a very strong demand for notes overall. Some people use them for transactions. Some people will use them more as a store of value, as contingency. Some are abroad in sort of bureau de change. So the whole range of different things that drive people to use cash. And as long as the public demand cash, we want to make sure we can supply notes to them.
So that's it, Ellie. Should we have put part of our £50,000 into the £4,150 for a plastic £5 note? Good investment?
I wouldn't have thought so, to be honest.
There we go, moving on. Now, Simon, why is that the case? What's going on here? And do you reckon that's it for cash? Is it out?
I like to think it's because lots of people have been reading Lee Boyce's stories about coins that are actually worth more money than their face value, and that something akin to sort of tulip mania has taken over, and people are now out on the streets paying more for money than the money is actually worth. What I actually think it's to do with is the fact that the auctioneer's Spink basically said that this note carries the serial number AA01000017, which makes it the lowest available to the public. So if you think about it, it's a genuine collector's item. A new banknote, not just a change of a picture on the banknote, it's a new banknote. It's the first plastic banknote. It's the lowest publicly available one. So someone has looked at that and gone, that's got long-term value. And over the course of the next 10, 20 years, if they're a collector, they're going to think, well, this is going to be in demand because they're not going to make any more of these. They're going to make plenty more of these fivers, but they're not going to make any more of the first, the lowest publicly available one. Now, what's interesting is that it had carried an estimate of £1,200, and it sold for £4,150. So whoever has bought it is taking part in the same kind of thing that you see when classic cars or bits of art suddenly smash records. And you look at them and you think, well, yeah, they don't make any more of those, you know, Ferrari 250 GTOs kind of thing. But it's a lot of money to pay for one.
Well, if you got the money, why not?
Well, the first note was given to the Queen. Do you think she'll sell it? And the money does go to charity as well.
There you go. Bonus. Now, everybody, I'm afraid to do this to you. I am so sorry. As we all know, it is the most wonderful time of the year, early October. Yeah, not exactly. But it is when we start that inexorable slide towards Christmas. Actually, that started in August. Co-op, you do not need to sell mince pies in August. Hamley's Toy Shop, though, releasing a list of its predicted top 10 bestsellers. Better get the cards out, parents.
I don't know if it was butter popcorn or rotten egg.
You can turn the Jungle playset into a command center with a hidden computer.
It's troll time.
Goodness, that's creepy, isn't it? Sounds like an advert for Stephen King movie. It too or something. Well, as well as the Pie Face Showdown, includes a spinner game called Bean Boozled, where players risk eating jelly beans that taste like rotten fish or gone-off milk. There's even the ever-popular smartwatch for kids, the Kiddie Zoomer, the theme song of which is the bane of all adults. Oh, Simon. Oh, God. So what's on your kids' Christmas list?
I don't know. It's my eldest.
Kiddie Zuma.
Well, it's my eldest daughter's birthday tomorrow, so I've got that to deal with first. And then my youngest daughter's birthday is on the 23rd of December, so my kids' Christmas lists are not at the forefront of my mind. To be honest, what is on my kids' Christmas list is whatever they just saw on the television.
Kiddie Zoomers, Bean Boozled.
Funnily enough, their lists have got a lot smaller since we cut back on our Virgin channels. And now they no longer watch lots of Nick Jr., which has adverts on it. So there's less... Nickelodeon Jr.
You could say anything to me right now, Simon. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I'll tell you what, though. We were looking at the pictures here of these toys, and there's Star Wars-themed drones, right?
So I'll take that one.
Yeah, it's like Star Wars, X-Wings and stuff like that, but they're actual drones and they fly around. Yes. How much would you have wanted that when you were a kid?
That's pretty cool. What stood out for you, Ellie? What do you fancy? A pie in the face?
Always.
A great suggestion there. Someone was talking about that pie game face thing. It's sold out. You couldn't get it anywhere. But...
Just make your own.
Absolutely.
I think it's charmingly homemade, don't you think? Isn't that nice?
Paper plate, bit of whipped cream.
Who needs a drone when you've got...
Hours of entertainment with your family. Honestly, we've settled on an idea there. We should patent it. Oh no, someone already has. Simon, final word for you.
I think that basically, probably the best thing you could do for your children's Christmas present is buy them an empty box, because we all know kids love empty boxes.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.